yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yes, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now, walk the streets a screaming now. Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, today's topic, and I hope everyone can hear me all right, I'm having a little static on my end, is entitled More Economists Are Predicting Great Depression, Either Now or Around the Corner. What's going on? You know, most of these mainstream economists are pretty conservative in what they talk about. And now we've got some of them actually using the D word here, depression, right? So let's look at a little bit of what's going on in that area of the economy. In other words, mainstream economists who are now saying that the economic crisis is not only not going to be V-shape, they're saying, they're even doubtful that it's a W-shape. Well, let's see. Let's see what they say. I'm referring primarily to a forthcoming article in the prestigious Foreign Affairs Journal for September. Should be out very soon, if not already. September, October issue. Now, Foreign Affairs is one of the journals that capitalist policymakers follow very closely. You know, this is big corporations fund this thing. It's joint business council and, you know, different business groups here, policy groups. And Foreign Affairs is a pretty important journal. It reflects an important area of thinking. And the article is about, two economists from Harvard. Well, I know one is from Harvard, Carmen Reinhart and her husband, Vincent Reinhart. Now, Carmen is the chief economist for the World Bank. And Vincent, her husband, is chief economist for Mellon Bank, you know, a big private investor bank. You know, only rich folks put their money in Mellon. You don't get to put your money in Mellon. So this is a pretty important new view within the capitalist class that's beginning to emerge here. And we'll see who and how picks up that theme as the economy begins to weaken going forward here. So, you know, let's look at their essay, which is entitled The Pandemic Depression. Subtitle, The Global Economy Will Never Be the Same. Okay. Now, others have begun to preemptively mimic it. You know, the dean of liberal economists, Paul Krugman, has this influential column in the New York Times, right? Has a piece of about a week ago entitled "Coming Next: The Greater Recession." What the hell's a greater recession? You know, Paul Krugman coined the term "Great Recession" back in 2008. Except then, he never really defined what a great recession was. He simply says it's worse than a normal recession and not as bad as a bona fide depression. Actually, Paul was flirting with the term depression back in early 2009, but he fell back to the term great recession, you see. Kind of like economic analysis by adverbs, great. Well, what does great mean? And how is it worse than normal, but not as bad as a depression? Well, I took that up in my 2010 book, Epic Recession, I called it. And I used the word epic to distinguish from Paul and others throwing around the adverb great. And in that book, in the first couple of chapters, I define quantitatively and qualitatively the difference between a normal recession and a great recession. So, you know, I put some definition to it. You may or may not agree with the quantitative and qualitative elements that I use to distinguish a great recession from a normal recession. But at least I put a stake in the ground and said, well, this is what the difference is. Okay. But now Paul is talking about a greater recession. Well, how is a greater recession different from a great recession? Well, it sounds like it's sort of somewhere between a great recession and a bona fide depression, huh? Yeah. Well, check it out. August 7th, New York Times. Coming next, the greater recession. You know, sort of like a cautious, safe way of saying what Reinhardt's are saying. They're not mincing any words. They're calling it a great depression, or the pandemic depression, as they say. And they've been repeating a lot of points I've been making over the last 5 months. And by the way, we will, after I review this essay by the Reinhardts, we'll turn back to some of my updating on what's going on here. Right? It's very, very clear from what they say that they're not mincing any words, as they say, to quote, "This situation is so dire that it deserves to be called a depression, a pandemic depression." You know, they're not cutting corners here. They're calling it for what it is. And why is it a great depression? Well, for a number of reasons, not just the magnitude of the contraction, which globally, according to World Bank, will be a shrinking of the global economy by more than 5%. You know, global GDP, I think, is about 18 trillion is global exports. Well, I think it's like in the $70 to $80 trillion area. I may be wrong on that, but I think I remember seeing something global GDP. Well, 5%. You're talking about significant GDP contraction going on. Well, in the U.S. alone, in the second quarter of this year, you knocked off $4 trillion in GDP. The U.S. Contracted on an annual basis 33%, actually 32.9%. These figures have come out. This is not a prediction. That's a fact. 32.9%. Germany contracted 34.7% on an annual basis in the second quarter, about the same as the U.S., right? The Eurozone, 40.3%. Japan, 27.3%. And Britain, a whopping 52% in just one quarter. Of course, that's all on an annualized basis. But if you just look quarter to quarter, what was the contraction in the second quarter compared to the first quarter, you still get around 10% on average here of all these major advanced economies contracting. China, by the way, contracted in the first quarter because the COVID hit it earlier by 6.8%. Very, very large contraction for China. Okay. Quarter on quarter, the numbers are about 10%. Germany, just under that for the U.S. Japan, about 8%. The U.K., 20%. And just one quarter drop. See, there's several ways you can measure the decline in the economy. You can do it on an annualized basis. Whatever happened that quarter, if it continued for a full year, that's an annualized basis. Or you can do a quarter to quarter, preceding quarter to this quarter, or you could do it year to year quarter. In other words, compare the second quarter of this year with the second quarter of 2019. So there's different ways of measuring it, but whichever way you measure it, it was unprecedented contraction in the second quarter. Not even in the depths of the 1930s depression did we get a quarter contraction anywhere near as steep as we had in the second quarter. Now, when you get that kind of steep contraction in the real economy, what happens is the economy gets fundamentally wounded. So it's not just the COVID health effect that caused that. No, it's other fundamentals overlaid on top, or the COVID is overlaid on top of those effects. As I've been saying, you know, the COVID phenomenon precipitated the deep contraction, accelerated it. But fundamentally, it was already baked in to the economy, U.S. and global. It was already slowing down. It was already very weak. And by the way, I've been saying that for some time. You know, since late last year, I've been warning the economy was very weak, you know, that we were in a manufacturing recession for 6 months and business investment had been declining for 9 months and defaults on credit cards and consumer debt was rising. You know, go back to my blog, jackrasmus.com, and, you know, my entries late last year or early this year and saying the same thing. Watch out, raising the red flag. Well, you know, the Reinhardts, they say the same thing. They said that, you know, the economy in 2019 was not all that great, that it was pretty darn shaky. Well, that's another area, I guess, in which we agree upon. Well, that's the picture, second quarter. Now, they also raise a theme in their essay, similar to what I've been raising, and that is that what we've been experiencing in June and the early part of July is a rebound of the economy in the U.S., not a sustained recovery, a rebound. They distinguish correctly between rebound, which happens simply because the economy reopens up to some extent after it shut down. I mean, you can't keep contracting 33% every quarter, subsequent quarters. I mean, you would quickly end up in 6 months with the entire economy shut down, you see. So that's impossible. So we opened up, and that's a little rebound going on in the economy. But the rebounds aren't necessarily sustained, and they can relapse. You can get a relapse. That's why you get a W-shaped recovery. You get a little bit of rebound. You then eventually get a relapse. The relapse could be a slowing down of the growth rate, or it could be actually a contraction of the economy again. That's a double-dip recession, you see. And by the way, Japan is in its double-dip. In fact, Japan was in recession in fourth quarter 2019. It's been 9 months now in recession. Europe was stagnant, pretty much, no growth at all, especially the UK and other economies. You can get a second recession, you know, or just a stagnation, and that gives you the W shape. And then you get a short, shallow second rebound again, very weak, and that's followed by another relapse. And you can bounce along the bottom like that for years. That's what a great recession is. You know, very weak recovery growth because the initial contraction was so severe and so deep, and also because policymakers, you know, the politicians don't really stimulate the economy well enough, or they try to stimulate it with monetary policy primarily. In other words, give the money to the banks and hope that business loans them, and that's how you generate the recovery. Well, in great recessions, investors sit on and hoard and don't take up the loans. So you get a very, very weak recovery because of policy focus as well as the deep initial contraction. That's a great recession, W-shape, extended for years. And that's, of course, what's happened in the U.S. Right before World War I, we had a great recession. And the early phase of the 1930s depression was a great recession that then spilled over into a great depression after a series of four banking crashes every year, 4 years in a row. So, you know, great recessions are kind of like anterooms to great depressions. And maybe the Reinhardts and maybe even Paul Krugman now are seeing that possibility. Now, as anterooms, they can go either way. In other words, if you have a significant fiscal stimulus, you may tame it and it may fall back into a normal recession or a very slow recovery, but a recovery, a sustained recovery. Or the Great Recession can trip over into a bona fide Great Depression, particularly if you have subsequent shocks to the economy, to the real economy, usually caused by a financial crisis that follows. Because the great contraction in the real economy, you know, results eventually in businesses bellying up, going out of business, and defaulting, in other words, can't pay the principal and interest on their debt, defaulting, going into bankruptcy, failing, which causes a kind of psychological contagion effect, and businesses and banks then draw in their activity, don't loan or don't expand and don't rehire much, and then you get the prediction coming through. So contagion, psychological contagion for investors investing and hiring and businesses and bank lending becomes a significant factor here once you start getting defaults. And as I've been arguing, it's quite likely that if they don't tame this great recession sometime in the next spring, we could have a wave of defaults. Business defaults, household consumer defaults, state and local government defaults. That would precipitate the contagion effect, psychological and real, that creates a financial crisis, you see. And that would be another severe shock to the economy. And that would trip us into a Great Depression, for sure. The Great Recession we're in now would then morph into a Great Depression, as that has happened in the past. But, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean the second shock to the real economy, first has been the COVID, would have to be a financial shock, most likely, and if it goes on, inevitably. But in the interim, before next spring in a financial crisis, you could have another deep shock to the economy. You could have another significant wave of COVID health effect. And we'll talk about that, what that how that impacts the economy if we do. You know, they're talking about, you know, in the winter, people are more indoors and more, less free flow of free air and so forth. And people are mixing more indoors and that spreads that spreads the infection. You could have the flu season overlapping with the COVID season. We don't know how that will affect mutually both. Certainly, they're not going to cancel each other out. They can certainly potentially exacerbate each other, right? You may have a vaccine by the end of the year, but we won't know if it works or not. And they'll be using the general populace as the guinea pig, you know, because they're bypassing those normal trials to get the vaccine out there as quick as possible. You know, in Russia, they totally bypassed any trials. They're just throwing it out there and seeing what's going to happen. Then we have the problem in this country. 35% of the people, according to polls, will refuse to take the vaccine. I mean, even if you have a vaccine, and even if you can get it out to millions of people, which is another problem, because we just don't have the infrastructure and we haven't prepared. I mean, look at how we prepared for the testing, you know, totally haphazard still and insufficient. You think the distribution of vaccines is going to be any better? I mean, it's the administration of this has been chaos under the Trump regime. you've got the opening of the economies going on, which is going to continue. They'll never shut down again, particularly in the South and Midwest. That could produce another wave. They're talking about a wave here in the Midwest now, just like they had in the South. And you've got all these school openings. You know, they tried to open some colleges, Notre Dame, and they found immediately within a week 200 people infected, and they had to shut down again, go totally remote. The same's going to happen with K through 12, particularly high school. Right? All these factors have come together, and it could mean you have another wave of COVID and its negative impact on the economy. You know, more will have to shut down. Services would have to shut down. We're not shutting down manufacturing much, right? And we're not shutting down construction. And it's interesting that those are the two areas here in recent months where we're seeing a little bit of a recovery. But, you know, you add construction and manufacturing together, that's only 20% of U.S. GDP. 80% of the U.S. economy is services. And that's where the big damage has been done, on the services. We'll talk about what sectors of the economy have been harmed fundamentally and will remain harmed fundamentally going forward, and what areas are actually benefiting. You know, Amazon and folks, right? They're doing well, and will do even better here going forward. In other words, we got a fundamental restructuring of the U.S. economy going on right now, and that's got to be factored in and considered in any recovery. You know, it's not just the COVID effect now. You know, it's the decline of certain significant areas of the economy permanently. And then we got the political instability that's coming. I mean, folks, you can't imagine what's going to happen. I'm going to start writing about it, some scenarios of what this political instability around the election is going to look like. That political instability can only have a severe negative economic effect. Just as the COVID might come back, well, certainly will in some ways, negatively further impacting the U.S. economy, the political instability is going to do the same in the fourth quarter. On top of that, as I said, we may have the third element early in 2021, the financial instability effect. Right? So we've got three crises on the horizon continuing or certainly deteriorating or maybe even erupting here that have to be considered in the scenario of whether we're in a recession, a great recession, or in a bona fide Great Depression. And the Reinhardts are kind of emphasizing the latter. The Reinhardts are saying, you know, gee, look at it. And what they're doing in their essay here is also, since they're with the World Bank, looking at the really serious situation in emerging markets and the third world, which simply do not have the resources to deal with the collapse of consumption that the advanced economies have, right? But, you know, rebound should not be confused with recovery, their quote, right? And all of the worst financial crises since the mid-19th century, it took an average of 8 years for per capita GDP to return to the pre-crisis level. With historic levels of fiscal and monetary stimulus, one might expect the United States will fare better. But most countries do not have the capacity to offset the economic damage of COVID-19. And the rebound is just the beginning of a long journey out of a deep hole. Unquote. Unquote. Right? Okay. Looking further at why they think this is a Great Depression. You know, if you look at previous similar crises, let's look at 2008 and 2009, the global economy is important, far more important for other countries. I mean, like take Germany, half of its GDP is exports. And you get to other economies totally dependent on oil or commodity exports in the third world, emerging markets. You know, that's all collapsed, and they don't have the wealth and the resources for fiscal or monetary stimulus. They're in a worse shape. If you look at 2008-09, though, the Great Recession was mitigated by the fact that China blew right through it. You see, China spent 15% fiscal stimulus of its GDP immediately in 2009. They were the only country to really engage in a direct fiscal stimulus, not a monetary stimulus alone. The U.S. and Europe and Japan relied largely on monetary policy. In other words, tried to direct the recovery through the Fed, the central bank, and the private banking system so that the private banks would recover first and maybe they would loan and trickle down to the rest of the real economy that would, grow a little, recover a little more slowly, but eventually would recover. That was the monetary policy central bank focus of the recovery policy in the advanced economies, except for China, right? And, Europe, Japan, the U.S. got very slow recoveries as a result of that, but China blew right through it because of its massive fiscal stimulus. And China, of course, at the time, was, the big purchaser of commodities around the world. So it pulled up a lot of the emerging markets with it. Emerging markets in China, had a kind of a boom around 2011, 10, 11, while the rest of the advanced economies were lagging significantly. That's the difference between a fiscal focus in policy and a monetary focus. Monetary policy is always slower and benefits, investors and bankers and so forth first, rather than a fiscal approach, which puts money in the hands of workers and households and consumption, and then pulls business along. Well, when you got bankers running your government, guess which proposal they prefer, right? They prefer to go through the central bank and the private banking system. But the point here is that in 2008-09, the Great Recession was mitigated, offset, softened, dampened by the rapid growth of China and emerging markets. But we don't have that now, the Reinhardts are pointing out. We don't have that. What we got is all of them, the global economy everywhere now is in deep contraction. And emerging markets even worse than the advanced economies, right? This is quite different than the Latin American debt crisis of the 1980s or the Asian crisis of the 1990s, they point out, right? Or 2008 and 2009, as I just described. The World Trade Organization estimates global trade, in other words, exports, will fall this year somewhere between 13 and 32%, right? And even if you take the midpoint, the Reinhardts point out, right? That's worse than any year in the 1930s. So the global and export drag on recovery is greater than ever before, even in the 1930s. They point out that a lot of businesses will not reopen, and we're seeing that already, particularly in the services, right? They're not reopened, so you're not going to get a total recovery of employment and jobs. And those that do open and are able to stay open, we can see now in the numbers, are hiring people on a part-time basis and a temporary basis, in other words, at lower wages, just to test the waters. You know, a lot of these 10 million jobs in the U.S. that have been added May, June, July, about 10 million, a lot of them are part-time temp jobs being added. They just show up as a full job as far as unemployment is concerned, right? Yeah. Well, talk about jobs. The numbers that came out yesterday for new unemployment claims, new initial unemployment claims, 1.1 million new claims again. And that's just for the state unemployment system. You know, we were running a million plus for the state unemployment benefit system and about a million for the supplemental federal unemployment system called the PUC, Pandemic Unemployment Payments. All right, that's at $600 a week payment for gig workers and contract workers and so forth that don't show up, aren't eligible under state unemployment rules, right? So we've been running 2 million a week for 22 weeks. You know, that's 45 million people signed up for benefits since March, 22 million. Doesn't count the 6 million people who just dropped out of the labor force altogether. So that's almost 50 million people got unemployed, and we hired 10 million back. That means we're somewhere around 35 million to 40 million still jobless. Now, that's a whack on the consumption, which is 70% of the economy, a massive hole to climb out of because of this deep unemployment that still exists. And now they've gotten rid of the $600 stimulus, which provides about $75 billion to the economy. They've taken $75 billion out of the economy by allowing it to lapse. Trump is proposing $300, half of that. So, you know, if they put half of it back, actually it won't be half of it back, because so far we only got 12 states that said, okay, we'll participate in the $300 a week, will participate. 12 states, you know? So it's not, certainly not half. It's about one-fourth of half. Yeah. Well, why is that? Well, because the $300 unemployment thing, that benefit proposal, executive order of Trump, requires the states to put in another $100 in order to get the $300. Well, most of the states are broke. Their unemployment fund is broke. So they're not going to do it, you know, unless Congress passes a law and funds it. Because the Trump $300 a week is funded by transferring funds from the disaster relief bucket. You know, we got $44 billion there for hurricane season and fire season going on. Well, Trump's taking the money from there, which is unconstitutional, but he's doing it anyway. He didn't give a damn about the Constitution. No. And that's going to run out in 5 weeks. So, you know, we got 5 weeks with maybe another $5 billion, $10 billion. While we took $75 billion out. Now, don't tell me that's not going to have a major impact on consumption and GDP in the third quarter. Yes, it will. Yes, it will. Well, okay, the economy is recovering here in construction. You know, there is a little bit of a surge in construction, residential construction, housing spending. Not on the commercial side. That's totally busted. You know, commercial property construction. You know, hotels, resorts, malls, office buildings, apartment buildings. No construction going on there. That's the total bust. But the residential side, housing, there is something going on because interest rates are coming down, mortgage rates are coming down, and you got this phenomenon of rich folks living in the cities, running away like rats leaving a ship for the suburbs, right? They don't believe this COVID thing is going to end, so they're getting the hell out of Dodge, you see. And that's stimulating suburban sales, residential sales, you know. It'll do great for Long Island, but boy, they're leaving Manhattan in droves. Okay, so, you know, you got a little bit of a growth there in construction. You got a little bit of a growth in manufacturing going on. But no rehiring, no growth in hiring in manufacturing. No, businesses are figuring out ways to open up and increase production with fewer workers. Now, they always do that when there's a recession. They figure out, gee, I don't need as many people. I can function here and run my business with fewer. So let's lay them off, right? But the rest of the economy is the service economy, 80%. And that's the economy that's in deep trouble here in the U.S. And what that means, as the Reinhardts point out, is that the folks who work in the service economy are going to get and are getting whacked the most, the hardest. You know, this is where you have the lowest wages. This is where you have the least job security. This is where you have the, you know, the less unionization going on. This is where people have very few resources to allow them to, you know, tide over a crisis like this. These are the people getting hurt the most. And, of course, the biggest proportion in that group are minorities, you know, Latinos and African-Americans and so forth, right? And young folks as well, you know, who in the last decade or so have been pushed into the service economy, the gig economy, the part-time contingent job economy with low pay and no benefits and no security. And they're pissed off. I don't blame them. You know, millennials and Gen Zers. You know, the Harris poll, they had a Harris poll last week, and amazing. And, you know, both Biden and Trump ought to take notice of the fact that the poll showed in people between 18 and 39, 59% of those polled said that they would prefer socialist government over a capitalist system. Now, of course, you know, what they probably mean is not the above, not capitalism. They, you know, what is socialism? They probably don't have a clear idea of that. But they know they don't like what they got. 59% up 9% just in 6 months. Yeah, 59%. Wow. And if you another poll by Pew Research poll here recently in the past week, workers 18 to 29%, in other words, Gen Zers and some late millennials, only 10% said that they would strongly support Trump, and only 11% said they would support Biden. Well, those are pretty low figures. That tells me these folks are going to stay home. They're not going to bother voting. Okay, so that's a little bit of a political digression of what's going on, but you know, back to the Reinhardts here, right? The point they're making, the poorest countries, emerging market countries, right, already weakening last year because of the trade war and the collapse of commodity prices and so forth, are going to be impacted even more harshly. And within the advanced economies, the poorer income areas of the economy, you know, the working class and the services industries are going to get impacted even more severely. So in other words, as they say, the third salient feature of this crisis is that it is highly regressive within countries and across countries. Right. In other words, the impact, the negative impact, falls more heavily on the poor, where wages are lower, and small businesses who are struggling in the service industries. Right. And that the impact on consumer behavior will continue to shift and change significantly. Significantly. If you look at what I call the permanent restructurings that are coming out of this crisis or developing in this crisis, right? I mean, you got industries that are going to do better than they did before. You know, Amazon, Walmart retail, online retail of all kinds, warehousing, home repair, you know, both services and materials. Residential suburban housing I talked about, the tech area where everybody can largely work from home, right? Big savings for tech companies going on, right? Software companies as more remote education, remote this and that occurs. Cable TV entertainment content, right? Manufacturing like in tech, not in autos. Not where you have supply chain disruptions, Although longer term supply chain, if they bring manufacturing back, will be a growth area. So you got sectors of the economy who are doing better and should do better, but you have other sectors that are going to do worse, much worse. The travel industry, radically downsizing and reorganizing. You know, airlines are going to be smaller, car rental fewer, airports in trouble, cruise lines, Uber in trouble, Airbnb in trouble, right? Anything that has to do with travel, business travel in particular, right? Hotels, casinos, resorts, entertainment, you know, cinemas, sports events, all in trouble. Restaurants, particularly the independent, smaller ones, local ones, going under. Malls, big change in malls coming on, defaults coming here, big box retail, Pennies and so forth. The oil and gas fracking industry, urban apartments, urban office buildings eventually, you know, I mean, they're leaving Manhattan now for the suburbs. Well, you know, a lot of those office buildings are going to be empty. So you got this, some areas doing better, some areas doing much worse on a permanent basis, you see. And much worse means fewer employees on a permanent basis, long-term permanent unemployment, structural unemployment beginning to happen now, totally separate from whether you reopen the economy after shutdowns. Permanent restructuring going on. Consumer demand is not only shifting, it's going to be lower on a net basis. Lower incomes will be hit the hardest. Business investment is going to stay low and cautious longer term. Global trade and exports, we talked about. Sovereign debt, in other words, government debt and defaults and austerity will be coming next year. And a massive private debt overhang is going to continue here with an impact on both consumers and business. These are the permanent restructuring changes that you're not going to be able to avoid here going forward. The economy will never go back to the old normal. There's a new normal. We haven't seen what it totally looks like, but it's not the same as what we had, and in some ways, much, much worse for a lot of people. Businesses as well as workers combined. Okay. Now, you know, in their essay, they talk about the road to recovery. Right? And they said that, quote, this rebound is unlikely to deliver a full recovery. The fiscal response has up to now been narrowly targeted and planned as temporary, unquote. Yeah, well, I've been saying that all along, right? You know, the $3 trillion CARES Act in March, only half of it's actually gotten into the economy. The other half's being hoarded by investors and businesses. They're not spending it. It amounts to only 5.5% spending in GDP, actual. Now, 5.5% is what Obama spent in 2009, and that wasn't sufficient to get a sustained rapid recovery of the economy in a contraction that was only one third as bad as the one we got now. So 5.5% wasn't good enough for a one third of a great recession magnitude compared to the present. How is 5.5% going to be sufficient now? It's not. You know, they've only spent half of it. That's because, once again, the major emphasis of the U.S. Policy for recovery is monetary, is central bank and private bank oriented. In other words, stuff it into the private banks and investors and hope it trickles down to the rest of the economy. You know, the $3 trillion is only $1.5 trillion. There's over $1 trillion in loans that haven't been picked up by medium and large businesses. They don't like the terms and conditions. And $650 billion in tax cuts that haven't been really used, invested. You know, all we got really was the $500 billion in unemployment benefits, $600 in the checks, and about $500 billion in PPP small business loans, which are really grants. That's it. And, you know, a couple hundred billion to the hospitals and for testing and so forth. That's not enough in a contraction of this severity, this depth, this magnitude. And now what do we got? Well, you know, now that they're supposed to have passed a real stimulus bill, because the CARES Act is just a mitigation bill, you know, it would have been worse than 33% contraction if it wasn't for the CARES Act. But now they're supposed to have really done a stimulus, but they're not doing it. They're not doing it. They're relying on monetary policy once again. You know, you hear about the CARES Act, $3 trillion. Well, you don't hear about the $3 to $4 trillion in the Federal Reserve, you know, without passage of laws by Congress. And that's why they set up central bank, by the way, under capitalism, so that they could funnel money to the big banks real quick and they wouldn't have to go through Congress to do it. You know, that's the purpose of a central bank. They've thrown out $3 trillion. You know, the Fed is buying up bonds, treasury bonds and agency mortgage bonds and corporate bonds and ETFs, exchange-traded funds and so forth. You know, to the tune of somewhere around $150 billion a month, every month, at least. They've already added $3 trillion to their debt balance sheet, the Fed, central bank. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the real bailout of the banks and corporations is going through the Federal Reserve, see? And the bailout of non-banks and households and service businesses goes through Congress. And they're even linked, you know, because Congress, you know, these loans, these $1 trillion of loans not taken up, will really be funneled through this narrow spigot of the private banks and the central bank, you see, to control the whole thing. Yeah. Okay, so, the Reinhardts are pointing out that that's not enough, right? That's not enough. And it's even worse, a monetary focus of the stimulus going on in Europe and Japan. And that's why their recoveries are always even worse than the U.S. Okay. This monetary central bank focus, you know, is going on again. Same error we made last time in 2008-09. And as they point out, this gives rise to what's called shadow banking. You know, unregulated banking that then uses the stimulus, the monetary stimulus, in order to speculate more in financial markets. Okay. They end up saying the shadow of this crisis will be long and dark. All right, more so than those of many of the prior ones. Right. And they emphasize the global economy role here, you know, since she, Carmen Reinhart's with the World Bank, right? And that's why they think it's going to be a depression. Mm-hmm. And they're probably right. It will be more of a depression, particularly if now in this slowing rebound going on here, a very uneven rebound. You know, maybe you get a little bit more in manufacturing and construction, but you get the worst situation once again in the services side of the economy. A triple crisis. It's a triple crisis. You see, it's the health crisis, the COVID thing that's really harmed the economy significantly, in which the specter of which come the winter. May do so once again, for all those reasons I already stated, okay? Fundamental restructuring going on, progressing, you know, underneath the COVID economic effect that's independent now of COVID. Then the political instability, which always dampens investment and spending. I'm writing about that, within a week. Check out my blog, jackrasmus.com. I'm writing Trump's Plan B. You know, what's his Plan B? And it's a really, you'll see a crisis, constitutional crisis coming out of November 2020, no doubt in my mind. The only question is how severe, you know, and whether it will be contained within Washington, D.C., and the elites and their institutions, or whether it will spill out to the rest of the U.S. We're going to see a couple dozen Floridas. Remember Florida, 2000, hanging chads, three counties in Florida's vote stopped by the Supreme Court. Stopped by the Supreme Court, gave the election, in essence, to George W. Bush. Yeah, well, we're going to see that happen in the couple dozen states now with Trump. You know, he's warning, he's signaling, you know, with the mail ballot fraud, right? And playing games in the post office, right? Slow it all down, create a crisis. You know, at the same time, we're going to see a lot more voter suppression being prepared, particularly in the red states. That's not been resolved. It's gotten worse. He'll hold on to the red states through those means, right? And they're punishing the blue states. You know, McConnell and Trump, they're doing everything they can to punish the blue states politically and economically here, refusing any kind of aid to the state and local governments. They know that it's going to be mass layoffs starting in September, October. And they're hoping this will impact the blue states where, you know, a greater need is you know, for some sort of rescue. And then he's campaigning intensely and will continue to campaign intensely in the swing states. There's only eight states that matter here. You know, the red states are still locked up. I don't care what Democrats think. They're not going to get Georgia. Come on, the governor of Georgia took 400,000 people off the rolls, maybe more, I don't know. You know, Greg Palast, the investigated journalist here, has been following that and other voter suppression quite closely here. And, you know, it's a repeat. That problem's never been resolved, voter suppression, particularly in the red states and some Midwest states. They've locked up the red states, the South, that way. The Republicans, the Trump-publicans. You know, it's not the Republican Party anymore. It's the Trump-publican Party. And then he'll campaign intensely. You can already see it. He's just going to the swing states, those eight states. You know, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Arizona, Florida, North Carolina, maybe, you know, several others in that area there. Minnesota, maybe. Florida. Those are the swings. That's the only thing that matters with the Electoral College, you see. Those eight states. And he's intensely campaigning there. And the question in my mind is, are we going to see Biden campaigning there? I don't think so. You know, try to do it remote. But this remote doesn't work all that well. I mean, look at the attention to the Democrat convention compared to the previous convention. You know, big drop off. People just don't follow it on TV. In the format, all remote talking head speeches, you see. So, are they going to get out there? You know, I mean, Hillary made the big mistake in 2016 and taking those swing states for taken for advantage and never showed up. That's why she lost them. Yeah. I don't know. The Democrats do the same? I don't know. And the Democrats, of course, have a big problem. Yeah, I don't believe they've really captured the majority of Sanders's young troops. You know, I don't think they've done that. And those folks, a lot of them will stay home, particularly in the swing states. The Democrats can't afford that. You know, we'll see. It doesn't matter what Bernie says to them. You know, they feel that they've been once again with this ticket pushed aside. And of course, they've been pushed aside on a platform, Democratic Party platform. So, it's a big question mark whether Democrats can win in the fall, I think, particularly if they don't intentionally go after those states, those swing states. And if Trump really is able to put the screws to the blue states and keep the red states in his corral here. Well, we'll see. But it's the triple crisis, you see, the political instability. And let's not put it past the fact that, you could have on November 4th, you could have a situation where it's not clear what the vote really is because there's so many challenged and enjoined by Trump lawyers' vote count of mail-in ballots in the blue states in particular. Because Trump has said, it's okay in Florida, you see. Mail ballots are okay in Florida, but they're not okay in Pennsylvania or some of the other places, right? Or New Jersey, right? They're already challenging New Jersey. They'll impound the votes, the mail-in ballot votes, and it'll take not weeks, months. In the meantime, people are going to be so upset. They're going to see massive marches on Washington and counter marches. And who knows when, feelings are so high and intense and you put masses of people against each other in Washington that way. I wouldn't even put it past Trump, bring in the DHS and all their SWAT gear and surround the White House, right? Or even call, and not even have to call, some of his right-wing buddies to come down and man the fence around the White House there. Boogaloo Boys, Proud Boys, QAnon, and all those crazies. And the Democrats think they're just going to remove him in that kind of a situation by January 20th. I don't think it'll be resolved by January 20th, 21, because the vote count won't be resolved. And you can't throw it into the House of Representatives under the Constitution because it's not a question of a incapacitated president or vice president. They're not incapacitated. It's a vote count issue, not a capacity of the president or vice president issue. So it'll go to the courts. And of course, we know he's got the courts all lined up now. Anyway, political instability going to be significant. And then, of course, the next thing is if this thing drags on and we get a further relapse because of COVID and the political instability in the winter, early winter, what will that do to accelerate the defaults and the bankruptcies that could lead to a financial crisis later on in early 2021, which would send the whole economy even deeper into contraction, even deeper? Well, I would suggest you all read the Reinhardt's essay when it comes out in the Foreign Affairs. It may have already. It's the September-October 2020 issue called The Pandemic Depression, where the authors really echo a lot of things I've been saying since March, finally now. And it's kind of an opening statement to the capitalist class. This may be real here, policymakers in Washington, because all the biggies follow the Foreign Affairs. It's a seminal journal for the elites in this country, and they've opened a debate here. They've legitimized the debate that this may be a depression already. We may be in early phase of it, and I'm saying if it's not yet, if it's still a great recession, then certainly the political instability, the further COVID effect, and financial instability that may be around the corner, almost certainly in some cases are around the corner, will certainly be sufficient, if it's not a great depression already, to push us over the edge. And the fact that we haven't done any real fiscal stimulus here, we should have here in August, is another exacerbating factor. There's virtually no fiscal stimulus going on now, and that's a big problem. And the Fed knows it, and the Fed says, we'll step up, but the Fed can only do so much. They can only preemptively bail out the banks, but that does not preemptively stop the collapse of consumption and investment in the real economy. That only tries to address the severity of it, of the effects of that collapse of the real economy. So that's the story for this week. And we'll be talking about more. Read the Reinhardt essay if you can get to it. Or maybe I'll just put it up on my website. That sounds like an idea for folks to read for themselves. You can get to my website, Kiklos Productions, from my blog, jackrasmus.com. But I'll be writing next about Trump's Plan B and about gaming of the bailout that's been going on, why it's not as significant as they're saying in terms of really stimulating the economy. Also check out my day-to-day comments on my Twitter feed at Dr. Jack Rasmus, where I point out some of these polls, as I said, Harris poll, Pew poll, and so forth, and some day-to-day economic developments, those three areas. Okay, I think that's it for today. We're almost through, and this is Alternative Visions, and we'll be coming back to many of these themes, I'm sure, in subsequent shows. I'm out.